journalist Elijah Magnier. Thank you. Spoke to us from Brussels. That does it for this edition of The Debate. For me, Kavit Tahweh, and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات لأبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines.
On this vote, the yeas are 223, the nays are 205. The resolution is adopted.
U.S. House of Representatives votes to urge Vice President Mike Pence to invoke a constitutional amendment to remove President Trump from office. The United States hits a record of nearly 4,500 deaths from the novel coronavirus in a single day. China expands its COVID-19 restrictions after recording the biggest daily jump in infections in more than 5 months. Welcome to the program. Our top story this hour, the U.S. House of Representatives has approved a resolution that urges Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Donald Trump from office.
On this vote, the yeas are 223, the nays are 205. The resolution is adopted.
The measure was passed with a final vote of 223 to 205. Pence has said that he would not invoke the 25th Amendment. He has said the move is not in the best interests of the nation. House Democrats say they will vote on Trump's impeachment on Thursday if the article is not invoked. The impeachment would address charges of inciting insurrection after Trump supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol last Wednesday. With that, Trump would be the first president in U.S. history to face impeachment twice. He has downplayed the risk of being removed from office.
And it's time for peace. And I'd like to say that free speech is under assault like never before. The 25th Amendment is of zero risk to me, but will come back to haunt Joe Biden and the Biden administration. As the expression goes, be careful what you wish for.
Trump also called the Democratic-led efforts to bring impeachment charges against him a witch hunt, a phrase he had repeatedly used during his first impeachment. Earlier, he described the initiative by the Democrats as a dangerous move. The developments come as Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has reportedly said the president has committed impeachable offenses. Several House Republicans have also voiced support for the impeachment. International lawyer Edward Corrigan says the U.S. House will definitely pass the impeachment vote against President Trump.
Well, I think the impeachment vote will definitely pass at the House of Representatives because the Democrats have a narrow majority there, but there's an indication of a number of Republicans that are going to join them. Mm. The Senate, the Republicans still have a majority until there's the transfer of power on January 20th, and then it will be tied, and then Vice President will have the tie-breaking vote. Mm. But there's some people, one senator, Senator for Alaska, Lisa Matt Crosby, said that she would like, she doesn't see herself as a Republican under the Trump administration. And Trump really has a cult, and he has done a tremendous amount of damage. And he's trying to just, you know, sort of have a total reign of destruction for the last couple of weeks of his power. And this is unprecedented. People were afraid that Richard Nixon might break before he resigned with the impeachment thing with you know, with Watergate or whatever. Right. But he did resign. He was pressured into that. Mm-hmm. But people were afraid that he was becoming mentally unstable. And I think the same concerns actually are even larger with Donald Trump.
U.S. National Guard troops deployed on the streets of the capital of Washington, D.C. have been allowed to carry weapons. The Guard soldiers were also authorized to make arrests if the situation got out of hand. That's according to the Pentagon National Guard Bureau Chief Daniel Hockensen, or Hockensen, I believe, however, said that that would be a last resort. U.S. officials are boosting security ahead of the inauguration of Joe Biden as president on January the 20th. That comes in the wake of last week's breach of Congress by supporters of President Donald Trump. Five people were killed as a result. The FBI has warned of armed protests at all 50 state capitals and Washington before Inauguration Day. To the news of the coronavirus, daily COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. have hit a new record with nearly 4,500 fatalities. According to data released by Johns Hopkins University, cumulative deaths in the world's worst-hit nation have now surpassed 380,000. The average number of daily deaths in the past week has now surpassed the fatalities of the 9/11 attacks. The U.S. has also so far registered more than 22.8 million cases of the virus. Over the past week, an average of nearly 249,000 new COVID-19 infections were reported every day. Vaccination is also underway in that country, but the government has come under harsh criticism for the program's slow and chaotic process. From the U.S. to China, the country has expanded its COVID-19 restrictions after a sharp spike in infections. A state of emergency has been declared in the northern province of Heilongjiang, I believe, where over 37 million people live. Residents there are not allowed to leave the province. Also in four northern cities, over 20 million people have been put under lockdown. On Wednesday, China confirmed 115 new COVID cases. That is the highest daily increase since late July. The country last year managed to bring under control its coronavirus outbreak with tight restrictions and a robust contact tracing system. For an update on the situation in China, let's cross over to China itself in Beijing, where I'm joined by our man Stephen Ribe, who is going to provide us with an update or whatever he has been able to find within the past few hours. Stephen.
Well, as you say, Heilongjiang, that's the most northern province of China. It's in the far northeast. It borders Russia. It means Black Dragon River, after the river that separates Russia from China. Anyway, one of the four prefecture-level cities under lockdown in China is in Heilongjiang, and the other three are in Hebei, which is the province that surrounds the capital, Beijing. So there is a bit of nervousness now, because from the get-go, China was very sensitive to instability in its capital. And the capital, as a result, had tighter restrictions than anywhere else in the country that was unaffected by the virus, or largely unaffected. For example, if you left the capital and you came back, you had to subject yourself to quarantine. I mean, even if you just go outside Beijing, you'd have to submit yourself to 14 days when you came back. But having said that, China has a tried, tested, proven, very well-oiled system now, apparatus, in place for containing this disease. In addition to lockdowns in these four prefecture-level cities, there are about 28 million people under lockdown now. There's mass testing. In Shijiazhuang, they're now testing millions of people. There's probably, most importantly, though, is tracking. Everybody with a mobile phone, and that's everybody, really, under the age of 70 or whatever, has this health app, which has to be clear. And any long-distance journey you want to take, whether it's by bus or train or plane, you have to show a green result on this app, otherwise they won't let you get on that plane. Even if you travel by car, once you arrive in a city from outside, there's a good neighborhood kind of monitoring system. You have to submit yourself to quarantine, and it's very hard to evade that. So that's what China's doing. I mean, everybody's confident, really, that it's going to get down to clear zero, I think is the phrase that it has used in the past. It's interesting, you know, the debate about freedom, which has popped up as a result of the virus and the epidemic. Americans say, well, they're not free in China because of these draconian lockdowns and all these restrictions on personal freedom. But, you know, who's free? Outside of these four prefecture-level cities, life is proceeding basically as normal. Until a week ago, there were no masks required in the most of China. Now there are masks required on public transport. But apart from that, all restaurants, all bars, all clubs, all shops, completely as usual with no face masks. And a lot of people abroad find that incredible, but that's the situation in China in spite of this new outbreak. So, you know, who's free? I mean, people in China have their freedom curtailed or restricted in some places through really, really severe, harsh lockdowns, but then it wipes the virus out completely and they're back to normal. So that's you know, an interesting debate that has sprung up as a result of that. I mean, in China, they'd say they're freer than they are in the US, and maybe they're right. Who's to say?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Interesting. Thank you very much. That's Stephen Ribe, our man in Beijing, updating us on the situation in Beijing, not only in Beijing, actually, you know, elsewhere in China. Thank you, Stephen. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has pledged to strengthen his country's nuclear arsenal.
While strengthening our nuclear war deterrent, we need to do everything in order to build the most powerful military.
Kim made the remarks in his closing address to the top of ruling workers' party meeting that lasted 8 days. He called the U.S. the foremost principal enemy of North Korea and a fundamental obstacle to the development of its revolution. Kim said the real intention of Washington's policy towards Pyongyang will never change, regardless of who is in power in the U.S. The two sides held summits in 2018 and 2019 that aimed to lift sanctions against North Korea in return for its denuclearization. However, the last summit in February of 2019 broke down and talks have remained deadlocked since then. Syrian media say Israel has launched fresh airstrikes on the eastern parts of the country near the Iraqi border. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Damascus to get more on that story.
A state news agency reported that there was an Israeli aggression on the city of Deir ez-Zor and the town of El Bukamal, which is in Deir ez-Zor countryside on the borderline with Iraq. After that, an official Syrian military source gave out a statement saying that about 1:10 a.m. Local time here in Syria, the Israeli enemy carried out airstrikes targeting Deir ez-Zor and Al Bukamal, and that currently the Syrian military is assessing the results of the damage of such airstrikes without giving further details on what was exactly targeted. But definitely, since that Israel has carried out an attack, the target is definitely some kind of locations for the Syrian army troops that are located there fighting the remaining terrorist groups in that part of Syria.
The U.S. says, without providing evidence, that Iran has ties with the Al-Qaeda terrorist group. The accusation has drawn criticism from Iranian officials. Earlier, we discussed that matter in detail with our guests in our news review program.
Tehran says recent U.S. accusations against Iran show Washington's frustration and failure of its maximum pressure campaign. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said resorting to these old baseless tricks and claims will not help the U.S. repair its tarnished reputation. Saeed Khatibzadeh made the remarks in response to accusations leveled by the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that Iran has ties with the al-Qaeda terrorist group. Khatibzadeh said that Pompeo had made the same accusations against the Islamic Republic in the past to divert attention from the real supporters of terrorism, which are Washington and its allies. Spokesman stressed that Iran's been a victim of U.S. state terrorism for years, adding Iran has a clear record of fighting terrorist groups. Earlier, the Iranian foreign minister dismissed Pompeo's allegations as warmongering lies. And now joining us for this news review is David Yahubian, professor of history, joining us from Cal State University, San Bernardino, California, and Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in sunny California with you, David. What's up, bud? Hope you're doing well. Your thoughts on the story, please.
Thanks, Daniel. It's always great to be with you. There's really not much that I could add to the statement by Mohammad Javad Zarif, because as always, he rather colorfully and accurately has called out the misinformation and the lies of the warmongers, in this case, Mike Pompeo. But what I think is important to consider is the motivations for Mike Pompeo to make this statement, this bogus claim, right now. And I think just briefly that there's three motivations that we can look to. First of all, he is trying desperately to throw up as much of a narrative and misinformation web, and as well, of course, a legal web to try to prohibit the return to the JCPOA by the incoming Biden administration. And so this most recent claim is I think, designed for that specific purpose. As well, he is politicking. Very clear. Right now, there's an article on foreign policy talking about how Mike Pompeo is trying to establish a legacy through a tour de force of Twitter bragging. So he's interested in potentially a 2024 presidential run with Nikki Haley. And so I believe that this also serves that purpose. But last, this is an attempt to obfuscate the fact that, to paraphrase him, the only new home for al-Qaeda in the last few years that we could speak of is the home that the United States and Saudi Arabia have enabled to be created in Syria, in the Idlib province, as well as in the so-called al-Tanf exclusion zone, where the United States and American tax dollars have gone to fund this motley stew of Takfiri terrorists aimed at overthrowing the legitimate Syrian government. So I believe that Pompeo's inane claim is designed for these three purposes.
Thank you, David. And hey, Tony, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Your initial thoughts on this?
Well, look, I think what's happened here, it seems as if the al-Qaeda franchise has been secretly bought by Iran from NATO. Now, that seems to be what Pompeo is implying here, like it's some kind of McDonald's franchise. Look, of course, inane, our colleague was saying. These are inane comments, and the only way Pompeo can get away with this, and he knows this, is to have a supine press full in the Western world of journalists who just refuse to ask the basic questions. And so that's why he takes courage to make such absolutely ridiculous statements about al-Qaeda. Now let's look at al-Qaeda's pedigree, shall we? Because it actually began in the closing stages of the Second World War, believe it or not, with the SS werewolf units, which were occupying Germany and the surrounding areas at the closing stages of World War II. They were what's called stay-behind forces, the idea being that as the Allies and the Russians rolled over German territory, that they would cause disruption behind the lines and sabotage and this sort of thing. This whole idea was then taken up by NATO in something called Operation Gladio, where NATO in the 1980s particularly, but in other decades too, conducted a campaign of bombing against NATO's domestic population, believe it or not. This is mainly instigated by MI6 and the CIA, but and also mainly in Italy, but also in Belgium and other countries too, where you had NATO fascist soldiers who were basically mercenaries working undercover for NATO, blowing up things like banks, kidnapping Aldo Moro, the guy who was slated to be the Prime Minister of Italy, and assassinating him. So these are what you would call black operations, special operations. And now, when it came to the 1980s and Operation Cyclone over in Afghanistan, these mercenaries basically were brought in and recruited into NATO by NATO and brought in. They brought in these first Islamist mercenaries, and from there they went on, for example, to Bosnia, to other places like that, to the former Yugoslavia, as Muslim mercenaries working for NATO, and they've been working for NATO ever since. Now, a point when it came to the September 11th attacks, of course, that was all blamed on Al-Qaeda.
All right, bud, thanks. Two great guys, very informative and always fun to have around. David Yahubian from San Bernardino, California, and Tony Galsing there joining us out of Brussels. That's a wrap for the segment of your News Review. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
While China has landed a spacecraft on the moon three times in the last 7 years, NASA has not landed there since 1972, the last Apollo mission. That could change in 2021, deepening the commercial transformation of American space efforts. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article authored by Michael Roston entitled Missions to Mars, Moon, and Beyond Await Earth in 2021. This article was published on the New York Times. Stay tuned. About a month after the new Christian year has started on Earth, three spacecraft will put into the vicinity of Mars. These explorers, which launched in July last year, will herald of a busy year of space exploration, launches, and astronomical occurrences. What follows is a preview of some of 2021's most notable expected events. Private companies and the world's space agencies are likely to announce more. The United Arab Emirates, China, and the United States all launched robotic missions to Mars last summer, seeking shortened voyages during the period every 2 years when Earth is closest to the red planet. The three spacecraft will join a bustling community of explorers either in orbit or on the planet's surface. The first to arrive will be Emirati Hope Orbiter, the first deep space explorer of the Arab country's small space program. The mission will study the Martian atmosphere, sending valuable data back to scientists on Earth. It is to reach its destination on February 9th. China's Tianwen-1 mission is also to arrive at Mars on February 10th. After orbiting the planet for a time, it will send a lander containing a rover to the surface in May. Landing intact on the solar system's fourth planet is perilous, and only NASA has done it more than once. A successful landing there would extend China's record of impressive space flight achievements, especially after last year's Chang'e E-5 mission to the lunar surface, then back to Earth with a fresh cache of moon rocks. Soon after, on February 18, NASA's Perseverance rover will arrive and immediately plunge toward the surface of Mars. If it lands successfully, the rover will seek signs of extinct life in a dried-out crater lake and riverbed. But first, it will deploy Ingenuity, a small helicopter. That device has its own mission of carrying out the first powered flight from the surface of another planet. While China has landed a spacecraft on the moon 3 times in the last 7 years, NASA has not landed there since 1972. The last Apollo mission that would change in 2021, deepening the commercial transformation of American space efforts. NASA has in the past decade relied on private companies to build and operate spacecraft that could ferry cargo, and now people to the International Space Station, ISS. It is trying a similar approach with commercial lunar payload services. The program has contracted with a number of private companies to build robotic lunar landers that will carry cargo from NASA and other customers to the moon's surface. The first company, Pittsburgh Astrobotic, is scheduled to launch its Pergamon lander to the moon in June. It could be followed in October by Nova C, a spacecraft built by Initiative Machines of Houston. NASA also has its eye on returning astronauts to the moon this decade. Its first step will be an uncrewed test flight of the massive space launch system built for future American deep space launches. The rocket has faced numerous delays and ballooning costs, but NASA still plans a journey in 2021 known as Artemis 1. It will send Orion, a capsule for astronauts, around the moon and back to Earth. That test is tentatively scheduled for November. Deeper into the deep space, the most significantly and scientifically important mission of 2021 has been a long time coming. The launch of James Webb Space Telescope, effectively a successor to the Hubble telescope, has been postponed for years, plagued by technical problems and mounting costs. NASA and the world's astronomers and planetary scientists are eager to see it get off the ground at the end of October. The agency settled on that time frame after coronavirus pandemic and other problems added another delay to the existing schedule. 2 other NASA explorers will also head out into the solar system. The double asteroid redirection test spacecraft, launching in July, aims to test whether a spacecraft could deflect a future asteroid that was headed toward Earth's surface. To do that, it will visit Deimos, a pair of near-Earth asteroids that travel around the Sun together and attempt a collision to notch the orbit of the smaller rock. A second mission, Lucy, will launch in October and travel much farther, making flybys through Jupiter's orbital path. There will be another study, the Trojans, asteroids that travel in the same orbit as Jupiter, but hundreds of millions of miles ahead or beyond, trapped there by the giant planet's gravity. Scientists think these space rockets could conceal secrets of how the solar system's outer planets are formed. Human spaceflight was transformed in 2020 as SpaceX successfully launched a pair of crews to the space station. The company is likely to send more astronauts to orbit in 2021, and not all of them may be working for NASA and other governmental space agencies. Multiple companies are working with SpaceX to launch paying customers on the Crew Dragon capsule. One of them, Axiom Space, could send its first private tourists to the space station late in the year. When NASA picked SpaceX to build transport for its astronauts, it also hired Boeing to do the same. During an uncrewed test to orbit in December 2019, a series of errors nearly led to the catastrophic loss of Boeing's Starliner capsule. To make up for that unsuccessful flight, Boeing will carry out a second test flight as early as March. Other human journeys to the space also beckon this year. Virgin, Galactic, and Blue Origin may send paying customers on short trips to the edge of space and back in 2021. China could also start launching pieces of its next-generation space station during the year, setting it on a course to have a regular human presence in low Earth orbit in the years to come. If 2020 taught people anything, it was to expect the unexpected. While COVID-19 darkened the world as it traveled around the sun, humanity was surprised by views of comet Neowise in the summer months and enthralled with the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn during the winter solstice. It's a big universe, and there's so much of it to be seen from our smaller part of it. A lunar eclipse on May 26th will overlap with a period when the moon is closer to Earth than usual. What some call a super blood moon. People in Australia and on Pacific Islands, as well as in Western United States, will get the best views of the occurrence. And some of the event will be visible in other parts of the Americas, as well as East and South Asia. Most people in North America will have to wait until 2024 to experience the next total solar eclipse, like the one in August 2017. But on June 10th, some North Americans will get a taste of what's to come in 3 years, when an annular solar eclipse darkens some skies. Also known as a ring of fire eclipse, it happens when the moon is too far from Earth to fully obstruct the sun, leaving a halo of sunlight around its edges. This unusual eclipse will cross over the North Pole as it travels, and only people in small parts of Canada and Russia will get the full effect. But those willing to wake early enough on parts of the East Coast and wear their safety glasses will get to see a partial eclipse around sunrise that morning.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back to News. I'm your host, Saeed Bourza, in London, and we'll kick off this broadcast with news about Press TV.
Without any warning or explanation, U.S. tech giant Facebook disabled Press TV's account with nearly 4 million followers for nearly 24 hours. The page was reinstated after an appeal, despite the Western media giant saying earlier its decision was final. When quizzed, Facebook declined to give any further explanation for, quote, safety and security concerns. The move comes only months after YouTube blocked Press TV's account for the sixth time on its video sharing page and on Gmail, citing violation of export rules. The Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, which runs Press TV, has called such moves clear examples of pro-U.S. interest censorship and an attack on free speech. All right, let's get more thoughts on this. Joining me now, Mohsen Abbas, a political commentator. Mohsen, good to have you with us. What do you make of it all, this move by Facebook?
Well, it's all steadily in line with what's been happening for many, many years now. What we've got is capitalist totalitarianism emerging more and more, obviously. Surveillance capitalism is a term that we're all quite familiar with, which goes hand in glove with, of course, there have been mixed messages. Zuckerberg resisted for a while on Facebook. I mean, he claimed that it was not up to Facebook to police political speech, yet here he is doing exactly that. As the heat's gone up on these corporate institutions, so they are wilting and obviously working in tandem with other political interests. Let me just give you an example. Amy Palmore, the former Director General of Israel's Justice Department, was appointed on the Facebook Oversight Board. That gives you an indication of the kind of influence that Facebook, or the pressure Facebook must be under now, because she was on record chasing Facebook up to sort of ban certain free speech about Israel at that time. So likewise, American political establishment and other forces are at it. They're doing the same thing. They've done this to, of course, Press TV, but also Sputnik and Xinhua, the Chinese and Russian outlets, have been targeted as state media, you know, as if all of Western media has no partisanship with political and neoliberal ideologies. You know, over 200 pages were initially taken away from these press outlets at the time. Clearly, this is a war against the rising Eurasian, if you like, threat as they see it, and it's part of the maximum.
Well, Mohsen, let me get your view on this as well. Since it happened, a lot of reaction to the move by Facebook. One person tweeted that this move by Facebook comes ahead of a speech by the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in which he's going to accuse Iran of links to Al-Qaeda. Do you see any relationship in all of this?
Well, absolutely. Of course, you know, the Facebook, the power of these social media outlets is immense. The algorithms are now literally at the stage where they can direct people in certain directions. You can't say anything against vaccination. You can't question things around political policies of the West. But of course, there are voices that are now really major voices speaking out against this. Let me give you the example of Tim Berners-Lee, the father of the internet, no less, who gave birth to the World Wide Net. He hates this corporate capitalism that's going on and this kind of totalitarianism on these outlets. In fact, he hates it so much, he's setting up an alternative. He's actually challenging these major corporations, and he's taking them on with an altogether new system.
And Mohsen, one thanks for that example. One quick question that can be asked is, since when have giant tech companies become the arbiters of what the public is able to consume?
Well, ever since I think that they've basically set us all up for it. Of course, they needed 20 years to hoover up all the information, get us all hooked on there, get a kind of a psychological hold on people. Now, the party's over. I believe that now, increasingly, what you're going to see is that these tech companies are going to be politically maneuvered and forced by not only the states themselves, but also the deeper state, the money mafia in the background, will actually make sure these tech giants do as they're told and work in line with the Agenda 2030, for instance, the UN has been rolling out, which is all about controlling society, managing it in the interests of the powerful elitists.
All right. Well, the page is back up, and still we'll be able to get the truth out there for people to see. More than a bust. Thank you. To other news now. Across Europe, the number of COVID-19 cases and deaths are soaring. The World Health Organization had predicted the winter months were going to be tough, but with the new variants of the virus making it more transmissible and with lockdown fatigue setting in, experts are urging vigilance. Yanko Rahimi has borne this report.
The COVID-19 pandemic is taking thousands of lives every day, and families everywhere are struggling to find closure. No visitations before loved ones die, and new burial rituals are taking their toll. In parts of Greece, victims are being buried away from their loved ones in separate plots. In Italy and Germany, crematoriums are struggling to cope with the sheer number of grieving families and an overwhelming number of bodies. The dead must be handled with protective clothing and masks, and according to the head of this crematorium, the number of deaths this winter is 20 times any flu wave.
The crematorium is full, as you can see. The caskets are not only stacked one by one, but three times high. Here, in the memorial hall, there are also many deceased stored. We use all the space we have. From the quantity, you can see that there is simply an improbable mortality. Corona is real.
The World Health Organization predicted a tough winter, with the COVID-19 pandemic and flu season overlapping. But experts say this recent surge in cases and deaths is due in part to families mixing.
The number of contacts that individuals had and their families had increased significantly over the Christmas and New Year holiday. And that has had a direct impact on the exponential growth that you have seen in many countries. Some of the exponential growth we've seen in countries is almost vertical.
Several vaccines are now being administered across the globe. In Europe, rollouts got off to a shaky start, but are now picking up pace. In the UK, which was the first in the world to start inoculating the most vulnerable, 2.3 million Britons have already got the jab. But experts say it will take until autumn for everyone to get it.
This is an extremely serious moment for the country. And as good news as the vaccine is, it cannot be seen by any of us as a free pass to ignore the national guidance.
During this, the UK's third lockdown, the police are cracking down on people breaking the rules. The statistics show more people are out and about now than during the previous lockdowns, while hospitals cope with double the number of cases, as the new variant of the virus blazes through the population. Yanka Rahimi, London.
In other news of the day, aid agencies in Yemen have warned that the U.S. designation of Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization hinders their desperately needed operations in the war-torn country.
This was already the world's worst humanitarian crisis. It was already a situation where millions of people are struggling to afford food. Food rations have been halved for millions. Our famine warnings have just resurfaced. So this is really a life and death matter that we're talking about.
It is more relevant to consider who kills women and children in their homes and seizes the ports and blocks food and medicine as a terrorist.
UN Secretary General spokesperson Stefan Dujarric also warned of serious political and humanitarian consequences. The move bears the hallmarks of an administration keen to make an impact in its final days. It remains unclear if the incoming Biden administration will maintain this designation. Well, for more on this, Robert Carter joins me to give us some analysis of what's happening in Yemen. And Robert, you're in touch with people on the ground in Yemen. What does this 11th hour designation by the Trump administration mean, especially for the people of Yemen?
Thanks, Said. Well, obviously, a lot of people in Yemen, particularly on the ground there, are concerned, to say the least. Obviously, as everyone knows, Yemen has been a besieged nation for well over 5 years now. The only two ways in which vitally needed food aid is able to get in and out of the country is via the capital's airport, Sana'a, which remains closed to passenger flights, or the port city of Hodeidah, both of which are besieged, both of which are administered by the Houthi Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a. So, of course, this designation means that even any slim way in which people are able to communicate safe with their families in Yemen, they're going to probably find it very difficult to do so. So just sending money, small amounts of money into Yemen from, say, the US or Europe could get you in big, big trouble. In fact, you could get a jail sentence for doing so, as you'd be technically sending money to a terrorist-administered zone under this new US designation. So obviously it's been highly condemned, but I think from the actual official response from the Yemeni government is that, you know, the peace process has been failing for a long, long time in Yemen, and ultimately this is just the latest sign that peace talks might not be the way to break the siege. They might have to turn to military solutions in order to try and make that breakthrough.
So you spoke of a peace process. Does this mean that the Americans under this administration said, you know what, we've been supporting the Saudis in the war on Yemen to try and get the Houthis to their feet, probably hand them a defeat. It didn't work. Let's go ahead and designate them as an FTO, as a foreign terrorist organization.
Well, I think that the way the Yemenis see it, at least I can portray that to the best of my ability, is that the Saudis are essentially attack dogs that were given the green light to attack Yemen by Washington. They believe that this is a Washington-led war on Yemen, and they believe that Trump's administration, or his regime, rather, has basically profited from the war as much as it can. Now that the Trump's regime is on the out, they're basically trying to upset what Biden's administration could look to do as much as possible. There is rumors that Biden might look to bring about some kind of meaningful peace in Yemen, and this move by Trump and Pompeo are looking to upset that. But however, Washington Post has reported that apparently Biden's foreign policy team deeply disagree with the move to designate the Ansarullah as a terrorist organization. So many Yemenis are hopeful that Biden will come in and simply reverse Trump's policies, but that has yet to be proven. And quite frankly, after so many years of different U.S. administrations all supporting this war against Yemen and greenlighting Saudi aggression, can we trust
Biden?
And the
role of the UAE, Robert, should not be forgotten. They contributed like $20 million to the Middle East Institute, you know, with people, former administration officials who direct policy changes perhaps in Washington. Pompeo, the Secretary of State, was spotted with the head of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen, in Washington as early as yesterday. Are we expecting any more Pompeo action before the Biden administration is inaugurated, in your opinion, briefly?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's not just in regards to Yemen. They've already made their move to try and get the Ansarullah designated as a terrorist group, which is deeply damaging to the peace process there. But also we're expecting an anti-Iran speech. It's been suspected that Pompeo will try and link Iran to al-Qaeda, would you believe, despite the fact that Iran's been fighting against al-Qaeda on many fronts for many years now. So ridiculous claims of that nature will be made. Also, of course, the moves against Cuba and China are also expected and have been pushed ahead so far. So this is a rogue regime that's lashing out on its final days. And unfortunately, we're just going to have to put up with it until the oppressive regime that's gripping onto power as long as it can in the U.S. is finally ripped from the halls of the White House. But even then, I think it would be naive of us to hope too much that Biden's simply going to come in and make the world a better place. All U.S. Regimes have proven time and again that they don't tend to honor their promises very much. But let's hope that something will change for Yemen.
It's in the home stretch now, isn't it? Press TV's Robert Carter. Robert, thank you for joining us. And now let's take a look at some other stories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh has accused Israel of racism for denying Palestinians access to the coronavirus vaccine.
We condemn the racism of the occupation state, which boasts about the speed of vaccinating its citizens and neglecting the legal responsibility to provide vaccines to the people under occupation.
20% of the 9 million Israelis living in the occupied territories have gotten the jab so far. The Palestinian Authority has reached agreements with four companies to import vaccines in the next 2 months.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In this segment, B'Tselem, a human rights NGO based in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, has called Israel a non-democratic apartheid regime advancing and perpetuating the supremacy of Jews over Palestinians. Well, let's see how that's gone down on Twitter with Rob in Lakesh. Rob, Ed, what can you add to that?
Well, this is a very interesting report which has been filed. B'Tselem is the number one leading human rights organization, which is based in the occupied territories. And also focusing on what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in general. In its report, it stated that Israel is pursuing policies of Jewish supremacy over the native Palestinian population, and it is very specific in that it calls out the occupation of the West Bank, in which approximately 3 million Palestinians live, the illegal besiegement of the unlivable Gaza Strip, declared unlivable by the United Nations, 2 million people living there under siege, East Jerusalem al-Quds under occupation with 350,000 Palestinians living there, and also the undermining of what are known as Arab Israeli citizens, so Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, who are treated lesser than the Jewish citizens of Israel and are discriminated against when it comes to land registration and other services inside of the country. As well. So when we're looking at this report, it's a comprehensive look at what's going on. If you look on the B'Tselem website, they are very meticulous. They are by the letter of the law. They try their best to not make any mistakes legally when they are reporting on this. They report the facts on the ground and have, of course, done this for many years now. So they're a very reputable organization, and this has stoked a lot of anger from Zionists online who are against Israel being called a non-democratic apartheid regime. Also included in this report, they do state that Israel is essentially dominating all of the land between the river and the sea, and hence it is an apartheid regime because Palestinians effectively have no real autonomy. When it comes to the Gaza Strip, Hamas has its leadership there, its government there, but does not have full autonomy over that land. Israel controls it. When it comes to the West Bank as well, the Palestinian Authority has to work in the confines of what Israel dictates it must do. And also, we've just noted what happened when it came to Israel passing on vaccines to Palestinians. It has excluded 5 million Palestinians between the river and the sea from the vaccination process. And also, we know that Israel have been making strides towards annexing the land inside of the West Bank.
It so is, when we're looking at this as a pretty significant designation by B'Tselem, is it not, Robert? Bring us some of the online opinion on this issue.
Well, in response to a lot of the Zionist trolls, as they're called online, we've had quite a few pro-Palestinian voices come out and celebrate the fact that this has been declared. First, we have here is from a user called Julia, who says, Israel is an apartheid state, end of story, and it's not anti-Semitic to say so. It's a statement of fact of the way the Israeli regime operates across its territories and with different categories of residents. Also, we have another one here who says that Israel is the last remnant of European colonialist apartheid left to be dismantled, a dangerous racist European experiment that has badly gone wrong. Like all colonialists, they invade, occupy, or steal, and subjugate the countries they invade. The world must stop this.
The world must stop this. Robert in Lakesh with that story for us. Robert, thank you. 3 months after Russia oversaw a ceasefire between Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Russian president has met with the two countries' leaders in Moscow to negotiate the next steps in keeping the peace in Nagorno-Karabakh.
I consider today's meeting useful and of utmost importance because we have managed to reach an agreement and we have signed a joint statement on the development of the situation in the region. Today we have made specific steps on building economic ties and developing infrastructure projects.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan hailed the new infrastructure projects, but insisted the status of Nagorno-Karabakh was yet to be determined. I could do more with 30 pounds. The words of an angry British mother criticizing inadequate free school meals for children from low-income families in this country. Ahmed Caballo joins me now with the details of that story. And Ahmed, I'm going to call it pandemic profiteering.
That's a great way of describing it. And this story has caused real angry emotional response online because many feel that once again, children, vulnerable children in British society have been let down by their ruling government. Now, parents have been sharing images on social media about the amount of food that have been allocated by a private company. Now, there's one tweet that seems to have set it all up. We've got that tweet and we're going to go to it. And it's from Roadside Mom. Now, she says, free school meal bag for 10 days. And then she goes on to describe what she got. Two jacket potatoes, a can of beans, 8 single cheese slices, a loaf of bread, 2 carrots, 3 apples, 2 Sorin malt lunchbox loaves, 3 Fubu yogurts, some pasta, and 1 tomato. And she says, issued instead of £30 vouchers. As you said, she says she could have done more. And what's angered many people is, if children are vulnerable, why not give the parents £30 vouchers so they can go into the shop and buy what they need? Why contract this out to a company? And the cost of these items that were shown in the picture has been calculated to be around £5.22.
And Ahmed, so I think we all recall, sorry to interject, what happened when that was brought up. A Tory MP, a Conservative MP by the name